So yes, we are going to continue our gospel series today and talk about the idols of the heart. So I hope you're ready. Just touch your heart here. Just protect it for a moment. Because we're going to smash at it a bit today, so you don't have to take your hands away. I'm going to touch a few sacred cows today, a few things that might be a little bit personal, and I just really feel that God wants to lead us to look into our hearts and look at the idols of our heart, because this whole series about the gospel has really been encouraging you, encouraging us to make sure that the gospel is at the center of our lives. If there's anything else at the center of a life, a marriage, a family, a church, then you're going to be in trouble. You know, and I've seen lots of churches, I've been in seasons in this church where we've struggled to keep the gospel at the center, and it creates problems, unhealth when the gospel is at the center. But when the gospel is at the center, there's grace, there's truth, there's mercy, there's forgiveness, and there's freedom. That's what the gospel brings. It's the truth of Jesus Christ, his birth, his death, his resurrection, his life, that brings us to a place of freedom, not a place of restriction. And I showed you this image last week. I just want to show you again. It's gospel justification and sanctification. And we spoke about the gap. There has to be a gap. If there's not a gap, then what begins to happen is that our sanctification, so our good works and how we follow God and growing spiritually and things we might do for God, can actually bleed back into our justification. And that's why justification there, or the gospel, the good news about Jesus that sets us free, has a big red firewall there. Because you can't bleed your sanctification back in. You can't come to God and say, hey God, I've done all these good things, now I'm right with you, I'm justified. No, God's gospel, the gospel that came from heaven, the good news about Jesus is this, it's so amazing that if you put your faith in Jesus Christ, you are justified by faith. You are made right with God. There's nothing you can do. You are a child of God. You are a son, a daughter of the living God. You are adopted into the family of God, and anything you have done or will do means nothing because you are justified by faith. Justification by faith is Jesus in our heart, and we are clean in God's sight. We have the right identity. By faith in Jesus, our heart is clean in God's sight. So he looks at you and he sees a clean heart, not because of anything you've done, but because you have faith in Jesus Christ. Sanctification is still really important, but it's the second step. For those that have put their faith in Jesus Christ, then sanctification is our following of Jesus. So by following Jesus, the idols of our heart are removed. We learn right living. But right living can't precede right doing. Right doing is not a factor in the gospel because it's about right identity. The gospel orders, ultimately the gospel orders the disordered loves of the human heart. This is our key point today. And this is why we're going to touch a few sacred cows and God's going to deal with our lives a little bit, because the human heart is the center of everything that we do. Our thoughts, our dreams, our imaginations, our hopes, desires, everything comes from the heart. But as a human, as a fallen, in the Christian worldview, we believe that humans are fallen, so they're not perfect, which means our hearts are disordered. The loves, the desires, the affections of our hearts, they're not in the right order. But when we meet Jesus Christ and we choose to believe in him, he begins to order the loves of our heart. He doesn't necessarily throw all the loves away, but he gets them in the right order, the right priority order, so that we can live a life following Jesus Christ. I ended last week's sermon with this story, and I want to tell it again because I think it's really powerful and a great example of what we've been talking about with the Gospels. It's this story of a young man, and I'm going to put it on the screen for you so you can follow along with me. It is thus that the boy ceases at length to be a slave of his appetite, but it is because a more mature taste has brought it into subordination. The youth ceases to idolize sensual pleasure. So sensual means feelings, emotions, things that make us feel good. But it is because the idol of wealth has gotten the ascendancy. Even the love of money can cease to have mastery over the heart, because now it is drawn into the whirl of ideology and politics, and he is now lorded over by a love of power and moral superiority. But there is not one of these transformations in which the heart is left without an object. Its desire for one particular object is conquered, but its desire to have some object is unconquerable. And we spoke about this problem of what we love is not just a religious problem, it's also a secular problem. This is a human challenge. This is not just a church or a Christian challenge, this is a human challenge. The human heart, every human heart, no matter what you may be taught as a child or raised to believe or what you might believe now, every human heart is seeking for something to worship, has an object of desire, has something greater than itself that it is shooting for. And we spoke last week about kind of two kinds of young men. You get the young man who has never been to church, doesn't know anything about Christianity, he's just out there in the world, making his way in the world. And even for that young man, he has increasingly more, or adapts increasingly to new idols. And these idols are increasingly more approved. Approved by his family, approved by the culture, approved by the people's opinions around him that he believes are important. So as a young man, he just chased feelings and impulse, but then he came to a more appreciated idol. He got his life sorted out. He got a job. And it appeared that transformation had taken place, but really the heart was unchanged. It was just a new affection. But even after a while, climbing the business ladder and moving up to the city and becoming a businessman and making money and climbing the corporate ladder, he appeared to change again, to become more virtuous. Now a politician, a philanthropist, giving his money away, but really it was just a new idol in the heart. The idol was moral superiority, not really, this is a hard word, philanthropy in order to love and serve others, but really it was the idol of superiority, of knowing, of having power. But on the outside it looks like sacrifice, and what a man. What a commitment to the community. But the heart still remains obsessed, lusting, desiring things that are not God. And it's the same story for the young man that walks into the church. You know, walking into the church, it's expected, it's encouraged that sensual desires, especially sexual desires and chasing women, would be given up. So this young man meets Jesus and he gives up those things because it's socially acceptable in the church. But really his heart isn't changed. Now he just exchanged sexual encounters for these different ways of conquering in the church. Causes a bit of trouble in his small group and a bit of trouble over there because the idols of the heart are still remaining. Even though he's made a decision for Jesus, the competition between these competing loves. There's Jesus, but Jesus isn't really taken over his whole life. So the young man changes the sexual stuff because everyone looks down on that in the church, but he just has a new affection, a new object of desire. Now it's to be a pastor. Now it's church leadership. Now it's maybe just to marry a nice girl and have some kids. That's very approved of in Christian circles. But is the heart really changing? Has transformation really occurred? The Bible talks about this as idols. Everyone say idols. It's not a very common word that we use in our vernacular, but it's in the Bible everywhere. Most translations of the Bible will talk about idols over and over again. But it's not so much these kind of idols. If you've read through the Old Testament a little bit, there's lots of talks of idols. Idols of stone, idols of wood. I think this is Buddha. Someone correct me wrong, my Eastern religion is not up to speed, but I think this is Buddha. It's not so much talking in the New Testament about idols of stone and wood, or idols of Eastern religion, or idols of ancient religion. It's not so much talking about those kind of idols, it's talking about the idols of the heart. But let's jump back to the Old Testament for a moment before we get to the New Testament, because God says some pretty direct things, i.e. in the Ten Commandments, actually the first commandment in Exodus 20, God says to the people of Israel, his people, you must not have any god, small g, before me. You must not make for yourselves an idol of any kind or an image of anything in the heavens or on the earth or in the sea. You must not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God who will not tolerate your affection. Everyone say affection. Your affection. Everyone say affection. That's right. We need to cooperate here today, right? Let's be a team. He will not tolerate, isn't this interesting? This is way back in the Old Testament. He will not tolerate your affection to any other idol. You see, at the center of our lives will be a God. Whether that's a God with a capital G or a small g is the question. This is not a human, this is not a church problem, this is a human problem. Everyone has a God. Everyone has a higher power. Everyone has an object of affection. Martin Luther, the famous reformer 500 years ago when he was alive, said that if you break the first commandment, you've already broken all the other nine commandments. All 10 commandments hang on the first commandment. You lose the first commandment about gods and idols, things like cheating and lying and adultery and dishonor and breaking the Sabbath and all the other commandments that God gives will be broken, because it's about what sits at the center. Is it a little g God, or is it the big G God, the invisible God? And it was a really odd predicament in the ancient world. The only people, the Israelites, were the only people on the face of the earth who had a God that you couldn't see. Everyone else made a God that you could see. It's interesting, in Ezekiel 20, as I was researching this week, there's this incredible summary of God's relationship with his people Israel. And I've put it in our practice for this week if you want to read through it a bit more clearly. But basically it goes like this. God says to his people, Israel, you were slaves in Egypt and I delivered you. But then you would not let go of the idols. And these were literal stone and wood type idols, the idols of the Hittites, the idols of the other peoples that lived in the nations neighboring Israel. So I brought you, God says, into the promised land. This is the great story of the Exodus from Egypt and God delivering his people into a land flowing with milk and honey. But you didn't obey, you didn't follow my laws, you didn't keep the Sabbath. And in verse 16 it says, because your hearts were devoted to idols. So God says in Ezekiel 20, I look to the next generation. So I went to the young people, the teenagers, the young adults, and I went to them thinking maybe their hearts would be with me, but they too turned to the idols of their parents. And eventually God says, and this is where it gets a little bit heavy, God says, so I let your children be sacrificed to idols and also to be carried off into exile. And if you know the story of ancient Israel, they were carried off to Babylon and other nations as they were conquered. But he says right at the end of Ezekiel 20, but a Messiah will come, someone will come who will break these things. In Romans 1 and verse 20, now in the New Testament, it says, for ever since the world was created, people have seen the earth and the sky. Follow along with me if you can. Through everything God made, they can clearly see his invisible qualities, his eternal power, and his divine nature. So they have no excuse for not knowing God. Verse 21, yes, they knew God, but they wouldn't worship him as God or give thanks to him. And they began to think up foolish ideas of what God was like. As a result, their hearts became dark and confused. Claiming to be wise, they instead became utter fools. And instead of worshiping the glorious, ever-living God, they worshipped idols made to look like mere people, and birds, and animals, and reptiles. So the Apostle Paul, as he lays out his incredible teaching on the gospel in the book of Romans, starts off and right there in chapter 1 saying, God is obviously here. He's written in the sky, he's written in the trees, he's written in humanity. God is invisible, but he's visible everywhere in what he has created. But people chose to make things out of wood and things out of stone, little g gods, in order to worship those instead of God. So he goes on in verse 24. These are some of the consequences. The Apostle Paul says, so God abandoned them to do whatever shameful things their hearts desired. As a result, they did vile and degrading things with each other's bodies. They traded the truth about God for a lie. So they worshipped and served the things or the idols that the things God created or the idols as God's creation instead of the Creator himself, who is worthy of eternal praise. When we worship things instead of God, we start to get an idea of our problem today. Our problem isn't so much this in Australia, in Western culture, a real physical idol, but the New Testament begins to expand the definition of idol to be the desires of the heart, the affections of the heart, the objects that we orientate, the things that we long for, the things that give us comfort, the things that give us approval, the things that give us a sense of control, the things that give us power. These are the idols of the heart. For us, things instead of God is, well, we use God, but we worship shopping. We use God, but we worship people's opinions and approval of us. We use God, but really we serve our own plans for a good life. This starts to give us a more of a sense of a modern day idols. Dan Alanda says that idolatry is placing our longings for what only God can provide. He is the source of life in the hands of a creature instead of the Creator. The modern day idol is this. It's the things, probably not stone and wood, although there's a lot of Buddhas around Botanic Ridge where I live. You would be surprised. Almost every second house has it. There's a house right near us that has a Buddha head. It's almost as tall as me in its front garden. This is Western people using Eastern idols as a source of just, you know, garden gnomes. Not really understanding that it's not the physical idols that are our problem these days, it's the idols of our heart. An idol for today is when we put our trust and draw our life from something other than God. The good news about Jesus, the gospel we've been talking about, gives us an opportunity to draw life from God. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father, so God, except through me. It's through faith in Jesus that we can soar, we have a source of life, of meaning, of purpose. But the moment we don't draw that from Jesus Christ and following him, we are automatically, there's no neutral here, we are automatically drawing our source of life from something else. Have you ever wondered, how do people change? How do people transform? We talk about transformation and change a lot in church, but how does that happen? Where does that happen? We get all kinds of funny ideas about magical prayer lines or magical conferences or certain speakers on stages or whatever, but that is not the source of transformation. The source of transformation is God. And the way that people change is by removing the idols that are in their heart. So the question for us today is, what is your source of life? What gives you meaning? Where do you draw your approval from, your comfort from, your sense of control and power from? Is it from things or is it from God? This is how it looks for us today. We're going to get a little bit practical here. It's like two trees, and trees is a common metaphor in the Bible used for human beings. So imagine yourself as a big giant tree today. Above the soil, we produce fruit. We produce good fruit, we produce bad fruit. But the reason we produce fruit is because of the roots, what's down underneath. If anyone understands the basics of biology, you understand this. We draw something from the soil as a human being. The soil and the nutrients is where the life comes from. It's going to be some god, capital G, little g. Little g, God, is an idol. But what is drawing life under the soil is our heart. It's our insides. It's our inner life. It's what's on the inside that needs nutrients that needs life. The interesting thing is what's happening in our heart and our mind and our life is all very secret. It's all very much below the soil. The fruit will give us away, but what's really going on in our hearts, no one can see except God. And it's what the roots, what our heart, like the roots of a tree, is connected to, is where we draw life. The idea for the Christian is this, that they would love God with all their heart, their soul, their mind, their body, and that our source of life would be 100% God through Jesus Christ. But let's be honest, I don't think there's anyone here who's at 100% level there, but that's the aim, because that's what happened in justification. Jesus died for you so that you can be 100%. And in God's eyes, you are 100%. He loves you, you love him. But the reality of our lives looks a little bit different. This is the growth bit, the spiritual growth bit. Before a person comes to Jesus Christ, they're only drawing life from idols. Their hearts are connected to, their roots are going out into the soil, but drawing from created things, earthly things, human people. And that may produce some fruit that looks okay, but in the end, it's just will be thorns. And in God's economy, it will just be thorns. It's the gospel, only the gospel, that orders the disordered loves of the human heart. It's only the gospel that can go beneath the soil and order our disordered loves. This is how people change. This is how you can change. When the gospel gets right into the roots of your heart and begins to deal with the idols that are there. The person whose heart has been dealt with by God, the mature Christian, the Christian who has lived a life of following Jesus, and many of these loves have been sorted out, looks something like this. When it comes to power, the desire for power, the human desire for power, the love of power, the longing for power, the mature Christian can say, well, Jesus is the king. My power is in Christ as King, therefore I can be humble. I can use my power to serve. When it comes to approval, the Christian can say, well, Jesus approves of me, therefore I'm unconditionally loved. I can use my position as being approved and loved by God in order to serve others, to reject gossip, to live a peaceful and contented life. No, we're not quite yet there yet, Ruth. We can just go back. Yeah, that's the one we need. My comfort is in Christ, that he lived, that he died, and that he rose again. There is nothing more comforting than the fact that Christ rose from the dead. If Jesus rose from the dead, then everything will be okay in eternity. Everything will be taken care of. And when we live in this as a mature believer, our comfort comes from knowing Christ, knowing his life, knowing his death, knowing his resurrection. As Paul says in Philippians 3:10, I just want to know Christ. I want to know him. I want to know his suffering. I want to know his death so that I can know his resurrection. That's where we take our comfort from. And control, well, my identity is in Christ. Therefore, I am secure. I'm a child of God. I can use this position of security and control to accept that I'm a limited human being, to be okay with living a life that's maybe not as spectacular as other people think it should be, but I live it through grace and humility, and I love people, and I do what God has called me to do. I don't need to control everything or control everyone. The tree with no fruitfulness, if we look back at the other side and the thorns there, the tree with no fruitfulness, it's very different when it comes to these meta-desires. Romans 1:22-23, we read it before, says their hearts have become dark and confused. Claiming to be wise, they instead became utter fools. And instead of worshipping the glorious, ever-living God, they worshipped idols. What are some of these idols? I could tell you that the main categories of idols we know pretty well. There's sex. There's money, there's power. I remember when I was a young adult, there was a clothing brand called Sex, Money, Power. Does anyone remember that? SMP. This is a little bit of a sacred cow, but a big one for modern people today is our kids. Our kids become an idol. This isn't a very sticky idol. Self can become an idol. Definitely. How I feel. Indulging the senses. Eating too much food. Why do we eat too much food? Because it gives us comfort. Where Jesus is meant to give us comfort. Stuff is a big problem. Buying stuff, having stuff, possessing stuff, eating at the right places, drinking the right wine, having the right friends, wearing the right clothes. This is where the heart, as Paul says, becomes dark and confused. What am I living for? Who am I living for? Who approves of me? What is my purpose? Where am I going in my life? And most people tend to rush around looking for these different people and things and possessions to fill that need deep within their hearts of life. I don't feel alive. Where through Jesus Christ we're offered life. In James 1, 14 and 15, James, the brother of Jesus, says, temptation comes from our own desires. Everyone say desires. Our own desires, which entice us and drag us away. These desires give birth to sinful actions, and when sin is allowed to grow, it brings death. And if you're a good Christian, you would have probably studied this scripture many times before. Temptation isn't sin, but temptation leads to desires. Desires leads to sinful actions, which means things outside of God, getting life outside of God. And then sin, when it grows, ends in death. For the wages of sin is death. You know what's really interesting when you study this? I've highlighted the word desires there. If you read that in the NIV, it will say these evil desires give birth to sinful actions. But that's actually not a particularly accurate translation because there's no Greek word that says evil desires. It's just desires. Desires is actually a neutral Greek word. It's actually used, the word for desires, I can tell it to you if you want, epithumia, is used in the New Testament actually more to represent good desires. So when the word's used throughout the Bible, it's actually talking about good desires more than evil desires. The word is neutral. So to have a desire to love our kids, because I know you all nearly choked when I put that there, but my kids, this is the modern day idol because, well, I must put food on the table and I must, you know, help them grow into well-rounded human beings. And everything we do is our kids, but how can Caleb put that there? How possibly could your kids become an idol? James sums it up really well. It's not that the desire is evil. The desire to raise great kids is perfectly normal, is valuable, is a good desire. But if we raise our children in a way that we draw life from them, we create an idol of our children. This is probably even more common for grandparents. We create an idol of our child, not that we are teaching them to worship idols, but they are an idol to us. If we draw our approval, our comfort, our control, and our need for power from our child, from a thing, from a job, from an identity in a position in a church, anywhere that we're drawing life from is immediately an idol. I shared with you very vulnerably at the start of my sermon last week about some of my idols. I didn't really call them that, but things I've wrestled with over the years that get in the way of God because I've drawn love, meaning, purpose, identity from those things. When we draw love, affection, approval from an idol, a thing, a created thing, it disorders our loves. Power. Let's take power for instance. Power is a good thing. I have a power position in this church. I'm the senior minister. That gives me incredible influence. I can open doors. I can shut doors. I can let things in. I can let things out. And if that power is disordered, then I'll tend to use people and things to worship some kind of idol, my success, my position. And for the Christian, it's easy because we just brush this idol away by saying something like, well, I'm doing it all for Jesus. Well, I have this position, it's all for Jesus. Well, I need, you know, that person, well, I know they got hurt, but, you know, I was just doing it for Jesus. To the secular person, it might sound something more like, well, I'm just a driven person. I can't help my personality. It's just who I am. It's just my temperament. I just love to win. I just, you know, I'm just good at it. I just, you know, I'll give some of my money away that I made. But like, I'm sorry, I crushed a couple of people. I'm just driven. I can't do anything about it. It's who I am. I'm just being my true self. When comfort is a disordered desire, I indulge myself to worship the idol of nice feelings. In the church, we might say something like, well, I've given a lot to this church. Well, I've given a lot to God. It's my chance to just sit back and someone else can look after me for a while. No one's nodding, so it mustn't be hitting a chord with anyone. In the world or not outside the church, it might be something more like, well, I deserve it. Work hard, play hard, right? I earned that money, it's my right to spend it. I spent my life studying, it's my right now to be like this or to go to this place or to have this thing. I indulge myself because really it's worshipping the idol of nice feelings rather than drawing feelings from God. You heard it brilliantly from Jordan before in his testimony. He sits in silence every morning, he's learnt to draw approval from God. The feelings of peace and love from God in prayer. The feelings of comfort, I'm okay, I'm loved, I'm approved of from his Father in heaven. That's how people transform. You don't transform by focusing on idols and trying to deal with them and get them rid of them out of your life. So don't go on a witch hunt after today's sermon thinking, man, I've got all this crap I've got to get deal with. You transform by having a greater love. Fall more in love with God and your idols will drop away. If you hear me saying today you have idols, you need to deal with them, then that's not the gospel and that's not what I'm saying. So let's just say it out loud. The minute I say you need to write down the idols and deal with them, we're back to good works. We're back to performance. We're back to just trying harder to be a better Christian. That is not the gospel. An effect of the gospel, the fact that you have faith in Jesus, may be, well, I want to take responsibility for my life and deal with some stuff and grow. Fantastic. But that's an effect of the gospel. That is not the gospel. Without the gospel, that just becomes work. Let's look at control. I do everything myself because I'm worshiping the idol of certainty. I have to do everything. I have to say everything. I have to talk to everyone. I have to make sure everyone's opinions of me are okay. I have to control it all, the kids, the family, the work. But these people tend to burn out because they run around trying to control everything because they're drawing life from certainty, from an idol that gives them certainty. Often this is a job because I can control this. I can be good at it. It gives me certainty and predictability in a world that's very unpredictable and very uncertain. And we Christianize it by saying things like, well, God told me to. Well, you know, just God told me to do this. I have to do it. But you seem like you're a workaholic. Yeah, but, well, you know, that's your opinion. You know, God told me to. In the world, it's a bit easier. You just say, well, people are idiots. If I don't control them, I don't talk to them, I don't tell them what to do, or I don't let them know this, or I don't push them here, or I don't, you know, follow my kids around until they're 25, helping them put their pants on every morning, then, you know, they'll never be able to do it. People are idiots. But really, it's your idol of control that is bleeding into everyone else's life. Approval, the final meta desire of approval. Where do we get approval from? Is approval bad, sinful, evil? No, it's just a desire. It's a desire that God's actually put in our heart to be approved, to be in control, to be comfortable, to have power, to have influence. He's put these things in our heart, but he designed them to be drawn from him. God has power, comfort, control, approval, but he operates with these tools perfectly because he's God. When it's disordered and disorientated, it becomes pleasing people to worship the idol of acceptance. In the church, we just say things, well, it's all about people. Well, you know, we're just here to serve people and love people. But really underneath, the idol that's sitting there is you want to be approved by people. In the world, we might say, well, I'm just easygoing. Oh, you're a bit of a doormat. No, I'm not. I'm just a lovely good, virtuous human being. Making idols of people. I've already mentioned this a bit today, but the great idol of other people's approval, the great idol of even our own children. The desire is good, but God is replaced by a child or a grandchild. Frank Clark says the most important thing that parents can teach their children is to get along without them. There's great parenting summed up right there. The greatest parent is the parent that can help their child be independent in a healthy way so that they can go off and live their life without you. But who will I be? What will I do when they're gone? What would I do with all my time if I wasn't fussing over them? Proverbs 22:6 says, start your children off in the way they will go, and then when they move away from you, when they're old, they will not turn from it. The job of the parent is to train the child to live in the right way so that their character is shaped, that they'll never leave that way because it's the good way, it's the right way. But the role of the parent is to train, not to be a friend. The moment when people become a friend of their child is because they're receiving something from the relationship with their own child that is not healthy. They're drawing life from the wrong place. They're drawing comfort, power, control. The desire is right, but the idol is wrong. The child, the grandchild, the friend, the roommate. This is so common in relationships too, in marriages, girlfriends, boyfriends. We draw so much of our identity from their opinion. And rather than be in an interdependent, healthy relationship where both the people in the relationship are encouraged to be assertive with what they need and what they want and how they're living, one gives to the other because really it's an idol. One dominates the other because it's an idol. Let's round this off today. How do we grow from here? Where do we go from here? A growing heart deals with the mixed loves in the heart. If we look at this next slide, it's a bit of 50-50. Maybe 80-20, let's say. We've met Jesus, we're following Jesus. Our hearts have been transformed as we're growing in him. So I'm not talking about justification here because that has happened. You are right with God. I'm talking about sanctification. I'm not talking about the gospel here. I'm talking to the effects of the gospel, what happens after you believe in the gospel. We're living our lives. We're journeying. Maybe you've known Jesus. Maybe you don't know Jesus. Maybe you know Jesus for 5 minutes. Maybe you've known him for 50 years. We're journeying and there's a mix in our loves. We're drawing mostly from God, and as we've grown in our faith, we've learned to rely on God and detach from other things. The great journey of your personal prayer life is really a journey of detachment. Every day that you spend time with Jesus, Jesus will constantly be saying, follow me, which inadvertently he's saying, detach, separate, cut the umbilical cord, whatever you want to call it. Just let go of the ties of your job, your money, your things, your possession, that new table you want to buy, those new shoes you need, the kids you're rushing around for. Just step away from that. Hand it over to me. Just let me give you approval and comfort and love. Let me fill you out. Let me be your source of life. Remember the quote at the beginning. An idol is whenever we're drawing life from something other than Jesus. So in order to change, in order to transform, it's not that difficult. We complicate transformation in this very difficult thing that maybe some good Christians can do, or maybe some people that get onto those magical prayer lines or conferences or have this super duper relationship with God that I don't have. Maybe they're the only ones that can change. No, change is much more simple than that. Transformation is simply the increasingly greater love for Jesus than for an idol. How do you change? By focusing on your loving relationship with God. If that deepens, the idols will become shallow and fall away. If that tie to God and drawing life from God gets stronger, the ties to these other things in this world will get weaker. If your revelation of who Jesus is grows, You'll repent more. You'll love him more. You'll be more grateful that he died on the cross. You'll be more grateful that, oh my goodness, God sent himself to earth to deal with the one thing that humanity couldn't deal with, their own sin and fallenness and rebellion and criminality. God did it for us. That just overwhelms my heart with love. And as I see that more, why would I want those things? Why would I pursue these things? It's so futile and ridiculous. And why would I ultimately fall into this position where I put my children or my grandchildren or my workplace or my boss or people I love, my wife, my husband, put them in the position of God? What right do I have to use them to be God for me, so that I can get through another day and feel okay about myself? What a rotten sin. What a disgusting, futile using of the people around me in order to give my life purpose and meaning, when God, the creator of the universe, is so evident and so visible. Yet I don't want to do the hard yards. Yet I'm not willing to lay down my attachments. Yet I'm not willing to even spend some time with him and listen to him and talk to him. This is why we need Jesus Christ. We don't look to our futility, our fragileness, our infinite nature. We don't look to our sin. We don't look to our idols. We don't go home and line all our idols up and go, right, Pastor K, whew, man, deal with this stuff. That's performance. That's works again. That's back to being kinder, putting more effort in, trying harder. No, we look to God. We look to his love. We look to his power. Don't try to dispel idols. Just love God more. Don't try to be better. Just follow Jesus with all your heart. Don't perform or fake. Just humble yourself in prayer. Don't try and be something at church or be something at work, or just build a prayer life, and God will do the work in your heart every day as you spend time with him. We're going to stand up and sing in a moment. And our gospel practice for the week is called Dealing with My Heart's Idols. I encourage you to go through this on your own. I encourage you to also go through this with a group or with your life group. There's some great stuff in there. There's a particularly great article called Idols of the Heart, which, if you get the chance to read it, it's really, really helpful and explains this far better than I've explained it. But I encourage you to go through that. We're going to keep doing these gospel practices for the next couple of weeks. We're going to have a little bit of a break after Easter, but then I want to, in term two, want to also, as we do another sermon series, want to also give you opportunities to practice this stuff every week. Not just one thing to, you know, as a sermon application to go into, but many things for you to look into and pray about. As I've said many times, there's enough stuff here that you don't need to think about what to pray. There's 7 days worth of stuff to pray over and meditate over. And I go over things constantly when I pray. You know, we approach things in this world and life, we're always expected to have a new thing, aren't we? A fancy toy, a new soundbite in the media, a new, you know, whatever, a new meal, a new restaurant, a new footy team, a new whatever. But Christianity is very different. It's actually not about new every day. Things to excite us every day. Things that are different every day. It's actually about going over the same scriptures, the same things, and practicing. That's why we call it a gospel practice. Christianity is about practicing. The minute we think, oh, I've heard that before. Oh, yeah, idols, Pastor K. Oh, yep, get it. Yeah, I heard that once. Yep, got it. All we're doing is consuming information that will never result in transformation. If you want transformation, it's about practicing the same things over and over and over until they become deeper and deeper and deeper.